You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those who are most in need. To help, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who help us all. If you're hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your frontline. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and the experience that you're looking for, and it puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements, so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, visit linkedin.com/Rome. Again, linkedin.com/ROME. Terms and conditions do apply.
A lot of these young athletes today, I hope they understand that, you know, this could be over in the blink of an eye also. Appreciate every day and work at it every day and give it your best every day, because when it's over, it's over. My what ifs, I don't have one what if, and that's pretty good for my mental state.
Hey now, what's cracking? Welcome to episode 132 of the Jim Rome Podcast. My guests this week are Jimmy Connors and his son Brett. Together, they host the Advantage Connors Podcast, and I am pumped to have both of them sitting together and taking a break from theirs in order to do mine this week. Jimmy, of course, is an absolute legend. He won 8 Grand Slam titles. He also held the world number one spot for a total of 268 weeks. He still has the record for most open-era tournament wins ever. Jimmy's got stories for days, and Brett adds the perfect color and perspective as somebody who grew up all around it. So let's get this thing started. Episode 132 is coming at you right now. Jimmy, Brett, it is so good to have you guys both on the podcast. Jimmy, let me start with you. It's been a little while since you and I got caught up, but you and Brett have busted out with your own podcast. It's called Advantage Connors. Jimmy, at this point in your life, you can do whatever the hell you want. Why did you want to jump into this space, and what are you looking to do with your platform, Jimmy?
Yeah, you know, Jimmy, it's, thanks for bringing that up. I've always, you know, kind of wanted to do something and on the radio or to have a voice and talk about tennis and, you know, a lot of things that go on over the course of not only my day but everybody's day. And Brett and I were sitting around. I guess Brett, correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was during the Australian Open. And all of a sudden he says, you know, why don't we sit down and talk a little bit about, you know, gambling and which has started to come into tennis now a little bit, and talk about the Australian Open and the odds and who you think's going to win, who's a dark horse. And, you know, so we kind of sat down, talked about it, and filmed it a little bit and came up with, a pretty good project. So, it's fun. It's fun for me, but it's more fun that I get to do it with Brett. He's on his own down in Santa Monica, and I don't get to see him as much as I'd like. And this kind of brought us together a little bit more, so I can see him and also hear his views, because, you know, his time around tennis with, you know, his business is in production and for tennis, and he watches more tennis than anybody, so he kind of keeps me up to date when I'm falling behind.
Hey, Brett, let me just jump in, Brett. I got to ask you, because I want to know what it was like not only growing up with Jimmy Connors as your dad, but Ilya Nastasi as your godfather, because it sounds cool as shit. Was it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely cool. You know, I think everybody knows those guys for all their antics on the court and then the personality and the bad boy stuff. But, to me, growing up, he was just dad. You know, he was just my pops, and that was just Uncle Nasty. You know, I didn't even question why, you know, his name was Uncle Nasty until I was a little bit older.
Great.
But yeah, man, I mean, it's just, it was great. I had a, you know, kind of a privileged childhood growing up around all those guys, you know, able to travel and be a part of the tour and have that during my upbringing. And I think, you know, that's benefited me in my career and doing stuff in tennis and production. And, you know, being able to do this with Pops has been really cool just because, you know, he's kind of got the old school on lockdown and, you know, he knows all the old players and the old styles and everything. And then I'm able to kind of, you know, bring the new school and a little bit of what's going on today, and I think it's a good mix.
Listen, I love this. Jimmy, I don't want to lose this point, because I think that when you say what you said about Brett, I get this, because I've got a couple of teenage sons right now, and I literally can't wait until they're old enough for me to throw back a couple with them, because I know it's going to be a great time. Now that Brett is a little bit older, what's it like to hang with him and then to collaborate on a project like this with your son?
Well, you know, I'm learning things. I've been, you know, kind of away for a while, Jim, and you know, to get back into it and, you know, get the feel of, you know, really of not only just tennis, but, you know, the way things really are. And I've kind of kept mostly to myself over the last number of years and have enjoyed that. But, you know, hanging with Brett I'm not afraid to say it. Brett's 40 and you know, time has passed.
Hey,
that's okay. You know, time has passed very quickly, and for me, I look back and, you know, I was traveling an awful lot while he was growing up, and even though my family was able to come with me quite a bit, I certainly did miss a little bit along the way, and so, you know, catching up and figuring a lot of things out, you know, from then till now has been great, but, you know, Brett is, he's modern day. And more things than just tennis, and you know, to sit down and to talk with him and to get his views and, you know, get a different perspective and a different understanding of, you know, the way a lot of things are, and so it's, you know, it's good for me because he keeps me up to date and you know, keeps my mind sharp, and, you know, with being under quarantine, that's been an important thing, to try to find a way to keep busy, and he certainly has kept me busy.
You know, Brett, I can just tell the affinity and the love and the respect that you two guys have for each other. It's very obvious. Like, Brett, one of my favorite topics is this whole notion of nature versus nurture. Like you said, you had kind of a privileged upbringing. You know, Pops came up gritty, East St. Louis. I'm kind of curious, like, your dad, like Jimmy, was running on some crazy rocket fuel his whole career. Like, if you could bottle that stuff, it would be the best thing ever. Jimmy was so fierce. I'm kind of curious, do you think that's nature or nurture? For instance, when you came out, were you hardwired the same way? How much of that, Brett, is environment and culture? Like, do you have that same fire in your gut that he did?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think I have some of it in me. I'm super competitive, you know, at anything I do. I mean, I grew up playing golf and some tennis when I was younger. But I think I'd have to say maybe it's a little more environment. You know what I mean? I think just being around him and absorbing, you know, his way of attacking things and looking at things and the way, you know, how hard he worked and how hard he practiced. And, you know, I used to go train with him when he was, you know, in the off season. I'd go run these hills with him when I was, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, and, you know, make it halfway up the hill, and he just keeps going, leaves me in the dust. You know, so I think it's a little bit of both, but, you know, I think I picked up a lot of it just from being around him so much. You know, I traveled a lot with him, probably a lot more than most kids my age are able to, and, you know, I think some of it definitely rubbed off.
Jimmy, you, of course, won 109 ATP events, 8 Grand Slams. You were a top-ranked player in the world. But you've been really clear about this, that the best weeks of your entire career involved a tournament that you didn't win. Of course, that was the 91 U.S. Open. For those who do not know or remember the extraordinary circumstances, Jimmy, of those 2 weeks, why were they the most memorable of your career?
I think most of the one thing that really stands out from those 2 weeks, Jim, is the noise that the crowd made. And that's what I wanted my whole career, is that the fans would get into it like that, like a hockey game or a baseball game or a football game or a basketball game, and just, you know, really, really lose it and get involved and feel like they were down there playing. And, you know, I played for over 20 years on the tour, and even though I was striving to try to get that throughout the course of those years, I never really figured that I had found it until those 2 weeks, because the noise there was deafening. And, you know, whether they, you know, liked me. They didn't like me. They wanted me to retire. They wanted me to stay around. You know, the idea was that they were there and that they were they could identify with a guy that truly loved what he did and had the passion for it every time he walked out on the court and was not afraid to show that. And I think that caught on to the point where, you know, after so many years that of leaving my DNA out on that court, my line with that, Jim, is, you know, in New York you leave your DNA there, they like that. You know, at Wimbledon they ask you to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, but the New York crowd and what they gave me and the noise and the feeling of welcome. That they had given me because I had missed it the year before. I had reconstructive wrist surgery and didn't know if I was going to ever play tennis again. And the welcome that they gave me back, and then the way they got behind me and pushed me. Because let's face it, I mean, I should have been out in the first round, you know, if it wasn't for that crowd. And you know, along the way, you know, they pushed me, and the harder they pushed me, the more I wanted to play for them. So it was. It was beyond a perfect match, you know, throughout the course of my career. But those 2 weeks was, you know, was perfection.
Right. Now, speaking of the wrist surgery, Jimmy, you may remember this. I'm sure you do. Brett, I don't know if you know this story, but I think as somebody in the media business, Brett, I think maybe you'll relate to this. On the way up, when I was in Santa Barbara because I went to UC Santa Barbara, and Jimmy, I'm sure at that time you had no idea who I was because I was a young reporter on the way up, but we actually had a mutual friend, if you can believe this, and that mutual friend was a guy named Dr. Rich Scheinberg, and he was the one that did the surgery on Jimmy's wrist, and the reason I knew him was I knew another guy named Kim Olson that I used to play tennis with because I played tennis in high school in the Valley, Brett, so we used to go to... Mm-hmm. Some of the mansions in Montecito because my guy Olson owned an insurance company and he tried to hustle business. So we would get on these courts with these rich guys. And as you guys know, sports is the great equalizer, right? These rich guys sucked. None of them could play a lick, but we used to tank all these matches, Jimmy, so my guy could get business, but he would never get any business, and we'd get our asses kicked. And I'm like, what are we doing here? It's the biggest waste of time. And my guy would say to me, hey, man, shut your mouth. We'll go to Harry's Plaza Cafe. We'll get a couple of bloodies. I'll pay for it. And this went on and on and on, and we never got anywhere. Point of the story is the doc says to me one day, guys, he says, Jim, you know I did Jimmy's surgery. And you know the doc, he's kind of laid back and quiet.
Right.
I'm like, are you kidding? You did? This was because there was no social media. This wasn't news. And Jimmy, you're very private. And I said, that's amazing. He says to me, would you like to interview him? I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. You think he would do it? He goes, I think he would. Meet us at Santa Barbara City College on the track.
That's right.
Jimmy's working. Mm-hmm. So we did the interview. I mean, like, fun fact, where am I going with this? Nowhere other than to say, Jimmy, that's how you and I met initially, but that was, he did your surgery. Now, the doc said to you at one point, Jim, I need to have a conversation with you. What was the conversation with Doc Scheinberg?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that story, Jim. I remember that story well, you know, after I did that, I'd been through a year of just nothing, and I couldn't play. My wrist was bad. I would sporadically go out and try to play a tournament, and, you know, I wasn't myself. So if I wasn't myself, I didn't really want to play. So I went and tried an event in Europe and got hammered and got on a plane and came back. And I remember calling Doc, and I said, geez, Doc, I said, you know, it's just not working out. He says, you're back home? And I said, yeah, I'm back home. He says, you're in seeing me tomorrow at 9:00. And I said, Jesus, Doc, I just got home. He says, you're finished. If you don't come in, you can't play. I said, you don't want to go play like that. You're not yourself. You're not playing up to your own expectations. So I went in and he went in and I went in to see him. He went in my wrist. And tried to find out what was wrong, and I was awake while the whole thing went on, Jim. I mean, it was an incredible thing, and talking to him, and after about an hour and 25 minutes, he says, "I got to close up now. Your arm can't be like this for any longer." He closed up, and I'll never forget the words he said. He says, "This is either going to work for the rest of your life, or you'll be done in 5 minutes."
Hmm.
And, you know, that was a little...
That's heavy.
little heavy. But it was right. So, I mean, I went home and was depressed, was down. I mean, everybody else is out training and playing tennis and, which was my job, which is what I wanted to do. And, so I really didn't figure out anything for weeks. And until Doc finally knocked on my door, because I know he had been talking to my wife Patty, and just came in and he says, "This is unacceptable." He says, "Get up, get out." And he says, "Because if this works, I'm not going to, go in and take a chance on, doing all this, having to be successful, and you be out of shape." So I got up and we went over and he started training with me, and got me up every day and worked me into it. And the more I did it, the better shape I got into, the more my mind got right, and until he finally, told me after, I think it was like 8 or 9 weeks, he says, "I'm going to change your cast," and he says, "I want you to go hit on a backboard, or have Brett and Aubrey throw you balls, like, when I first began as a beginner," and that's the way I got back into it. It was an incredible experience. I mean, would I want to go through it again? No, because I wasted a year and, everything else that I had to go through to do that. But the experience to get me through there, I knew then just how precious that time was. To give up a year, especially at that age, I was in my late 30s, 38, something like that, then to have to give up a year then, was a total waste. And to be able to go out and play again, I was not going to let that go by if I was able to play. And from the very first day that Doc got me out there, I said, my mind got straight and I had one goal. And that goal was that if I could go play was to make some noise at the U.S. Open. I played the French, had some success, played Wimbledon, had a little success, but once I got to the U.S. Open, I felt if I could win a match or so, I'd get stuck in the tournament, maybe I could make a little noise. And a little noise, came my way, which was pretty good.
It's amazing, Jimmy. The thing I'm struck by with that story is at that age, at 38, given what you'd already accomplished, you didn't need to do that. You didn't need to put yourself out there. You didn't need to go through the pain, the rehab, the surgery. But then again, that's always been your entire life and your whole career.
Yeah, I did have to do that, though.
Yeah, you did. Exactly. I was going to go there. Answer that for me. Why did you have to do that?
Well, I didn't want to be told to go. if I was going to leave, I had to go out on my own terms and know that I did everything I could to get back and to try to be what I thought I could be. And if I wouldn't have had that surgery and I'd have just accepted that, and kind of gone away with a whimper, that wasn't my style. If I was going to go, I had to go, trying everything to get back. Once I hit that first ball, once I played that my first match coming back, and I got hammered. It wasn't a problem. I wasn't there to win. I was there to experiment. To figure out if I kept going and got a little stronger, and what I had to do to make the wrist better. I was willing to try anything. And at 38, you look at that and you say, you're nuts. But I lived my life and played my tennis being nuts. And there was no time to stop now because my time was running out anyway, and to have one last shot, I'll never forget when I got through one of those matches, my friend Nastasi was watching, and he came up afterwards and he says, and it's been told many times, but he told me, he says, "You got what everybody else wants, Jimmy," and I didn't know what he meant, but he says you've got one more chance,
right?
And I said, if he's saying that, how do I step around that and say, well, give up? No, there was no give up then. Then it was just let everything out and, you know, hope for the best.
Now, never give up. I mean, your whole thing was, if it takes 5 hours, 7 hours, 10 hours, I'm not leaving this court until they drag me off the court. So all this work, Jimmy, and you set it up because you want to make some noise in New York, and you go to the U.S. Open, and, you know, hilarious in a way, you draw Patrick McEnroe in the first round. Given your history and rivalry with John, that was kind of curious. But then all of a sudden, and Jimmy, again, you're the epitome of not dead, can't quit, but then you're suddenly down two sets to none to Love, two sets down, three Love in the third. What are you thinking in that moment? I know you've never given up on anything, but truthfully, what were you thinking in that moment?
Well, you know, things happen so quick that, you know, I said all I need, because I wasn't playing bad tennis. I was playing some pretty damn good tennis, and at that time just getting beaten. So I figured that, you know, one something has got to happen here to change this whole momentum. Whether it was, you know, a shot or a fan or a call or, you know, something, you know, was going to have to switch some of the momentum. And you know, to be honest with you, I wish I could remember or go back and figure out what that was, because I don't remember. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, my whole mindset, my whole attitude, my whole game changed. Because it had to, because, you know, being down that far, I mean, it was, you know, in doing what I was doing, was not going to win that match. So once my, you know, my game changed, I became more aggressive. I became more confident in my shots. I became what I always was. it seems kind of crazy to say that, but I finally found that feeling of what it was like to be me. You know, that, you know, if that, once that caught on, then I felt that just stay in there and keep grinding. And you know, I made a living off of being a grinder, and you know, got into it and got stuck into it, and I got more confidence. You know, Patrick might have felt a little bit of the pressure coming his way, and you know, I ended up coming out on top, 6-4 in the fifth. But yeah, I mean, it was a storied beginning to a last good run.
Which led to the most amazing 2 weeks of your career. Like, Brett, Jimmy had sent you and your mom and your sister home. You guys were not there for that. So you're at home. Are you watching this? What were you thinking when Pops was down two sets to Love 3-0?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was watching. He'd sent us home the week before. Interesting story,
yes.
I got a second.
Yes, please.
He played the Hamlet Cup, which was a tournament that happened a couple weeks before the U.S. Open. You know, one of the prelims. And he won a couple rounds. I can't remember what round it was, but he drew Stefan Edberg in like the quarters, something like the quarters, I think.
That's right.
And he's up a set, and maybe even up a set in a break. And then all of a sudden, he stops doing what he's been doing the whole match. And I'm like, what the hell? What's going on? You know, he's been dominating. This is Edberg. He's the top, you know, two or three player at the time. And he ends up losing in three sets. And then we're driving back in the limo back to the city, to New York. And I'm like, what happened? You know, like, you had him, that's Edberg. You could have made the semi, you know, da-da-da. And he's just sitting there almost with this kind of calm look on his face, you know, like kind of just telling me, like, hey, it's okay. It's all good, you know. And now that I look back, what he was doing, you know, he was testing his game. You know, he was up a set in a break on a top three player, you know, and I think what he wanted to do is, you know, make sure his game was okay. You know, and then he didn't want to waste all the energy by making another round or making the semis or the finals. You know, he was saving himself for the U.S. Open. You know, so much of his year and a half before that had been focused on the U.S. Open. And so he figured he had had his, you know, his game was in order. You know, if he can get up a set and a break on the top three player, then, you know, he's definitely ready to play the U.S. Open. So that always sticks out in my mind that, you know, 2 weeks before, you know, he was already thinking about, you know, his first round opponent.
See, it's a great story because, Jimmy, you never – that's the thing. Like, I mean, like any other great athlete, you're going to go out there and get hammered sometimes, but you were never not prepared. I mean, never, ever not prepared. And I talked to Kurt Warner earlier today on my radio program, and I think both you guys could really relate to this, Jimmy, especially you. Kurt was talking about how he loved the film work. He loved the mental game. He loved to think his way through a game. And I know you love to think your way through around a match and to figure it out. If I were to ask you, Jimmy, what was your strongest tool then? Was it your game? Was it your mind, or was it your heart?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I I feel that you know, the intangibles are one thing that you know, especially in tennis, don't get enough credit. You know, if you look at the game, Jim, you know, you go out there, everybody plays great tennis. They hit the ball well, and but it's those who have, you know, the will, the strong mind, and the heart, the guts, and you know, and you know, to understand what it's like when you get in a situation, you know, how to handle it, how to go about it. You know, don't waste your energy, don't waste your time. You know, everything is done for a purpose. You know, you asked me, you know, what was good. Certainly, you know, to win tennis matches, and especially Grand Slam tournaments, which are 2 weeks, so, you know, playing 3 out of 5 sets, you've got to be doing everything well. Playing the game and being in a good mental state. But if you leave out that intestinal fortitude, you know, what you have inside, that you can never be let out, left off the table. Because, you know, when you got somebody who's got that's willing to go out there and stay and play 5-6 hours with you no matter what, you know, that wears on the other guy as much as it's wearing on, you know, would wear on me. But I was prepared for it. I hate to give you a flippant answer that, yeah, it was all three, but, you know, especially getting later on in life and missing in my career and missing a year before, you know, I had to adjust, you know, to go into that tournament if I was going to stay and play into the second week. And I did a few things very well, and was able to abide my time well on the courts. I became more aggressive and didn't stay so much on the baseline, so I tried to get into the net a little bit more.
I remember that.
But what I had inside, I wish I still had that in a lot of things. I miss that. I love the Rocky movies, Jim, and, you know, anything that has to do with sports. But there was one line in the last Rocky, and he was going to just go in, and I remember him saying, he says, "Sometimes I just can't breathe." And because it's down there, because you never really get that out of your system, you know, and because you miss the training, and you miss the travel, you miss the matches, you miss the glory, you miss the, you know, the getting hammered, you miss all that, you know, and sometimes in unless you are lucky, and I have been very lucky because I was able to play, you know, until I was 50, so I got it all out of my system. But if I wouldn't have been able to come back and play after that wrist surgery, I would have had that in me, that I can't breathe, because I wouldn't have gotten it out of my system. And I'll never, you know, I go back to that line because it's true. To have that in a movie, because you usually wouldn't hear that from somebody unless they were one of the guys out there doing the grinding and playing and being one of the players. But it was in a movie, and I've never heard anybody else say it that way. But I could identify with that, because it's you know, walking away from something that you put your, you know, you put your whole life into and your whole being to try to be the best at something, and all of a sudden it comes to an end, you know, sometimes that's tough to take, a lot of these young athletes today, I hope they understand that, you know, this could be over in the blink of an eye also. That things happen, you know, so appreciate every day and work at it every day and give it your best every day, because when it's over, it's over. There's no going back and saying, "I wish I could take that again." So you have to live with that. My what ifs, I don't have one what if. And that's pretty good for my mental state.
Well, that's amazing. What a powerful message. So, Brett, you ultimately picked golf over tennis. So what was it like playing golf with your dad on the way up? And what was it like the first time you beat him on the golf course?
Well, I mean, I played tennis, you know, till I was about 13, 14. And I tried to play both sports for a year in high school, and it was too much. So I was definitely better at golf. So I went with the golf. And, you know, he took me every day. He picked me up from school. Once he was little, once he was done on tour, and we'd go hit balls and we'd play nine holes before dinner, and he would always beat me. And then, I can't remember how old I was, maybe, 14, something like that, and I finally beat him. And, part of me was excited, but part of me was almost like, I beat him. Oh, no, is he going to feel sad, or something like that? And, I looked over and, he was more proud of my accomplishment than I was. So that just seemed like something that, was instilled from him, from his mom. I think she was probably similar because she taught him tennis and kind of had the same story with him when he beat her the first time.
It didn't take him long to beat me. He's being a little modest, Jim. It didn't take him long. He learned right from the very beginning and, took the lessons and, had everything from the basics down, and learned it the right way, and there's no substitute for that. It was like, me with the tennis. I got the good basics early, and then you kind of go on and sprout your wings and do other, and move on and try to become better, and that's exactly what he did. All through high school, he got nothing but better, and it was fun, when he'd take me along with him, saying, come on out and play with me once in a while, Dad, and, it was kind of fun for him to still, tag me along and get in the games, but He had a good game from the beginning, but he also had talent in the tennis too. He was a good athlete. He was was a good basketball player and played tennis, played golf, and a good athlete. When he didn't pick tennis, that wasn't a problem for me because I wasn't going to force him into that. It's a tough enough game. He didn't have to live up to, what he would think my expectations were of him. But even more important, the world's expectations of him. That would be unfair. So when he went to golf, I was actually kind of happy about that and proud of him for picking his own way.
I get that.
Yeah, I think that bothered me a lot more when I was younger, the tennis aspect and trying to live up to his name, and that probably helped kind of push me into the golf more, kind of gave me my own thing to have as mine. And, I look back at the times, those early days where we were both learning how to play is, some of the funnest times in my life, just because, spending hours at the course, trying this and videotaping each other's swing and going home and, watching it on slow-mo on the old, VHS recorders and stuff like that was great.
I mean, Brett, you want to be your own guy to be sure, and I know you're proud of your dad, obviously, but I remember even like growing up in Southern California, and that's a hotbed for tennis. I remember the junior tournaments. I can only imagine, obviously, the bullseye that must have been on your back as Jimmy Connors' kid coming up in the ranks, right, playing junior tennis. I mean, you probably didn't shy away from it. You probably went after it, but that would wear you down. That would wear anybody down.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think when I was younger, I was a little too sensitive to it, almost where I would put too much pressure on myself and get too mad. If someone beat me, I'd be like, you didn't beat him. You didn't beat my dad.
Awesome.
You just beat me.
Right.
I ain't shit compared to, I ain't anything compared to him. But, I think it frustrated me earlier, but I still use that, competitive drive and everything that he instilled in me, as a kid growing up, in my golf game. And, I played throughout high school and I played a little bit in college, and I try and still get out there and hustle the old man once in a while.
Good. And do you get over it? Does that work?
Oh, well, I don't know. You got to ask him what his handicap is from day to day. It seems to fluctuate.
It's got to. I play against too many bandits out here. It's too tough.
Yeah, right. You guys hit Sandpiper. Where are you playing these days, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, some of the courses are open up here. The Montecito Country Club is not open, and the gentleman that owns that club also owns Sandpiper and Rancho San Marcos. So those courses aren't open, but a number of the other courses are open now. So, we get out. I get out and I play. I try to play a day, maybe two a week if I can, which is good. But, I enjoy the golf, Jim. It's a good replacement, but it's not tennis. To me, I mean, my heart, my love, my everything is still to that game and somebody asked me the other day, he says, do you miss it? And, my only answer to that is every day. I miss everything about it. I miss the travel. I miss the practice. I miss the training. Most of all, I miss the matches, but, time is certainly caught up with me many years ago, but it's just that feeling of still thinking that hey, give me half a shot and let me go out and try it again. You know, that's kind of fun to think about or talk about once in a while, but I certainly don't harp on it. You know, my past is my past, and I loved it and I lived it and every day that I played it, but you know, it is my past, and I have I have such a great family, and you know, my life now is every Sunday I tell my my mom and my grandma and my grandpa and my dad, I thank them for this life they've given me, and I'm such a lucky guy.
It's so amazing. You know, Jimmy, whenever I talk to athletes about what do you miss most, inevitably they'll say the camaraderie, the fellas, but these are guys from team sports.
Right.
Tennis is so different. Like, I'm really curious. For instance, like in that fourth round of the Open, you played Aaron Krikstein, another famous match. You guys were good friends. You guys were tight, but the world's different. Like, I'm curious, when you watched The Last Dance with Jordan, and you could see that this guy did not want to connect with or fraternize with the opposition. He wanted to rip their throats out. This is the way it was when you played, and there were such amazing rivalries. But that's not to say that you didn't have friends. I mean, you were tight with Vitas. You were tight with Nastasi. You and Krikstein were friends. How did you approach that? Could you fraternize with those guys, or was it all business all the time?
No, it wasn't all business all the time. I mean, it was, you know, but when it was on the court, it certainly was, you know. I'll tell you the story of Nastasi.
Sure.
I mean, he was such a, you know, such my best friend from day one. He really took me under his wing, and we were under the same manager, Bill Reardon, at the time, and so he took me and really showed me the ropes at a young age, you know, good ropes and bad ropes, which was fun. But you know, the first I think 10 times that we played, he beat me, and the reason being was because I was too good a friend, or he was too good a friend to me, you know. And at that time I was young, and I couldn't separate the two. He could, I couldn't, you know. So I remember one, going home, and I just lost to Nastasi, and my mom said, you know, you better beat him, or you're going to lose him as a friend, you know, because he's going to lose respect for you. And that was that got into my head so quick that I said, you know, you're right. And from that time on, I think we became better friends, you know, when I started beating him. But I say that only because from that point on, you know, once I walked onto the court, it was all business. I could let loose a little bit after the, you know, to get away from it and all that. But when I was in it, I was in it, and I wasn't going to ever screw up. And even though I did a few times, I couldn't afford to, because too many people invested too much in me. My mom, my grandma, my grandpa, my dad, Pancho Segura, my wife Patty, my two kids. You know, I couldn't afford to screw up to the point of never giving it my all, because, you know, they didn't invest the money in me. It wasn't the money. You know, it was the, you know, the love and the care and you know, the allowance to me and going to take care of my business. Once I walked onto that court, you know, I was a different guy. There's no doubt about it. I like that. I love that attitude in me, and I miss that, because, you know, I'm older now and I don't have that release, so I don't have that. But I certainly miss that every day.
I mean, Jimmy, it was so much more than money. They invested your mom, your grandma, your father, your grandfather. They invested so much more than just money.
Like their life.
Their life.
Right.
Their life. I mean, you moved to Southern California to train with the right coach. You went to UCLA. You won a national championship as a freshman. Like you mentioned, your mom famously taught you to play. She taught Brett to play. Like, what was your mom like?
Well, I mean, she, you know, she was, you know, she handled me my whole career, really. And so, you know, she was, you know, a woman dealing with men in a man's game, you know, to deal. And back then that was pretty unacceptable. You know, so, you know, she was beyond gentle, beyond kind, but on at the same time, she was tough. But she knew when to be tough. And I don't mean just on me and in playing tennis. I mean, in everyday life. I mean, you know, she was not one. She was 5 foot at the best, 105 pounds at best. But you know, she wasn't going to take anything from anybody. And you know, from my standpoint, I think I learned an awful lot just watching her. You know, the way she handled her students when she would teach them. The way she dealt with people, the way, you know, she was around the game of tennis, and then the way she was when she wasn't around the game of tennis. And so she and my grandmother, all of them, my grandfather, my dad, you know, that what I picked up from all of them was instilled in me. You know, to say that just to say that, well, you know, my mom was tough. She was a stage door mom. She was none of that. Or she was all of that. You know, it's a matter of how you looked at it and felt about it. But I am going to say this, Jim, that she was for me 110%. You know, no matter what, you know, that she was for me. And once I got out there and was having a chance to make it, she let that be known. And people didn't like that. You know, they didn't want to hear that, you know, that she was so for me like that. So, you know, she got the, well, she never made it, so it's more important for a son to make it now. She was none of that. She made it on her own. But she instilled in me, you know, what she meant to me, that loyalty that she had towards me was something that was, you know, you could never get in between.
And I'm fascinated by that. Brett, I want to ask you about the podcast in 1 second. Just one quick follow. And believe me, guys, I could do this all day long. I'm going to wrap it up so I don't do this all day long. But Jimmy, I guess in a sense, like, I totally accept that and believe that and embrace that. She was not living vicariously through you. She had a life. You were extremely important to her, and she gave you everything she had. I wonder, it must have been so hard for her to watch you play. Did you finally get a sense of what it must have been like for her when you yourself started to coach?
Oh, she called me more every day when I was coaching with Andy.
Right.
You know, what do you tell him now? I think if you did this, telling me this would help. You know, did you think of this? You know, maybe we should. I'll call you later. You know, I mean, it was she was as involved from a distance as she could be, and Andy's success that he had along the way when we were together, she loved it. She kind of lived through that a little bit because she had gotten housebound, so she got to, you know, to know what it was like to almost, you know, be there only on the television again. And she was so happy because, you know, two people in the world, Jim, that loved tennis was my mom and Pancho Segura. They would watch tennis nonstop. They would talk tennis nonstop. And any time, you know, you give them a chance, they'd bend your ear on it. And that was, you know, I knew then what it was like when she watched me, because when I was coaching Andy, I think I was in the stands wanting him to win more than he wanted to win.
Sure.
And it was just, that was my nature. And he made me proud so many times. It was a fun couple of years that we had.
I can hear it in the family, the whole family thread. The thing I like so much about you guys, and I've never spoken to your mother, I never met your mother, but you could tell that, this is going to sound, not to be flip, but it's a no-hater zone. You guys are, there's nothing weird. You guys are, it's pure, unadulterated love. You're pulling for each other. Nobody's better than the other. This is family. This is blood. Like, and it brings me back to the whole original thing that you get to do this project together. Like, Brett, I think probably it's not a big deal to you because you grew up with it. You're in the business. It's always been like this. But the fact that you guys pulled Mike Tyson as your first guest is something. I've done this for 30 years. This is not an easy guy to get to. This is not an easy guy to turn around. And he's certainly, and I've had my moments with Mike, some good and some terrifying. He's not the easiest guy to be with either. When you get good Mike, it's amazing. Mike is like the most charismatic guy. But if Mike's not in the best way, look the hell out. Brett, what was it like to be with and interview Mike for your first guest on the podcast?
Yeah, it was pretty epic, dude. I mean, I've always been a fan, loved the guy, you know, growing up watching him play and fight, and, you know, and then seeing him kind of have some troubles in life and then pick himself back up and seeing him build himself the way he is now. He's back up on top almost. It was a little intimidating at first,
right?
You know, because it's the first time I've interviewed anybody. That was our first, I've done some stuff in my job, but never with real hard-hitting questions. You know, usually it's more soft fluff and, you know, weak little softballs that you lob the guy. But, you know, he was open to anything. I mean, you know, 10 or 15 minutes into the interview, he was tearing up and, you know, we're talking about family and ego and, you know, just, you know, he might be one of the most interesting guys in the world. But it was awesome.
I mean, Jimmy, you're as a world-class athlete, Jimmy, you know what makes guys tick, what makes guys go. How eager, Jimmy, were you to sit down with Mike, and how'd that go for you?
Well, I mean, Brett brought up the story, Jim, that, you know, I was playing tennis in Europe, and he was fighting, and they taped the fight for me so that I could, instead of staying up until 2 or 3 in the morning, that I could get up the next day and watch it. I mean, you know, he's the kind of guy. You know, for me, I mean, I loved Ali, I loved Frazier, and, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns and, you know, Marvin Hagler. I got to see so many of the greats fight over the course of the years. But Tyson was a different breed, a different character. He walked in the ring. He had his shorts on, he had his shoes on, he had a torn towel over his neck, and he was no frills. He just wanted to get down to business, and I love that. You know, I asked him. I said, "Do you study?" You know, because I never really studied my opponents. I just took my game out there, and you know, if that worked, that was good, or try to adjust. But he said, "I study." You know, before I walk out there, as I'm walking out, I'm looking at one last thing always, so I know exactly what I'm going to do. You know, and to hear that from the champ. You know, and you walk in and you're expecting, you know, somebody that's, you know, 6'6 and 260 or whatever.
No.
You know, he's not. He's 5'10, 5'11, but, you know, he's a truck. He's a tank. He's just going to come at you and just give you everything that he has, you know, from the minute that bell rings. You know, that to me, I mean, that's my kind of guy. You know, that it's like a Nadal in tennis and a Tyson in boxing, where you go out there and you're going to have to, you know, bury the guy to get him off there. And he was fun to watch, man. But to talk to him, and Brett said it right, he is one interesting guy. And to have picked himself up and got back in the game like he has and become, you know, just as, probably just as popular, if not more than he was back then. Geez, you know, what a story that is. Nothing but the best for him.
Jimmy, one last thought. Brett, I want you to make sure that everybody knows how to find the podcast and where to find you guys on social. I'm going to ask you that in 1 second. Brett, Jimmy, but to your point about Mike saying, when you asked him, did you study? How did you prepare? I can remember that era very clearly. And Mike, Jimmy, had so many guys beaten before they stepped through the ropes because he was so terrifying and he was so intimidating. Tennis is so unusual. Jimmy, like, could you win matches in the locker room before you took the court? Were you able to kind of intimidate guys and get in their heads before you even played them?
Yeah, but it was unintentional, Jim.
Yeah?
Come on now.
Come on now. I don't buy that. I don't buy that. Like, what the hell are they doing sticking everybody in the same locker room anyway? But
yeah, you know, that wasn't allowed in tennis. Come on.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not, Jim.
White shorts, white shoes, tennis.
Of course not.
Tennis changed, Jim. Tennis changed in the 70s and the 80s.
Yep.
It went from a country club sport, and, you know, I mean, everybody that loved the game, you know, seemed to just want to be a part of it. They, you know, we were losing, you know, the real sports fan. We playing in front of 5,000 people was great, great fans and all that. But, you know, we needed, you know, the hockey fans, I've talked about this many times, to build tennis to where it has become now. Those fans weren't going to put up with just guys hitting tennis balls, you know. And granted, we were the Wild West back then. There were no rules really. And did we step over the line? Sure, we did. But you know, but we had to, you know, we had to try to get tennis on a different level. and the guys that that I came up with, and the way they handled it, and you know, the charisma and the characters and the excitement that that they all brought to the game in their own way. Forget just the tennis, but even, you know, just as much Vitas's off the court life was just as important as the way he played his tennis.
God, yeah.
And that's what sold. That's what was selling. You know, not just the tennis. You know, you wanted to know, where did he go to Studio 54 after he just won a five-set match at the U.S. Open? That, you know, people wanted to know that, because we were real people. We were real, you know, we were them, you know, down on the court, you know, playing for them. That's and I think that's what caught on for tennis in the 70s and 80s, that they felt like they were us down there playing, and you know, what a fit.
God, it was the personality, man. Get it out of the country club. Give us some personality. Give us some rivalries. It was so awesome. Like, I got tired of asking the question of, like, well, what do we do? How do we get that back? Is it technology? Do you guys have to play with the Jack Cramers and go back to the wooden rackets? Is it just too much? Serve volley point. Serve volley point. Where's the personality? Like, Jimmy, what was it like to have Vitas with you in that run at the U.S. Open in 91?
Well, he was a good outlet for me, because he was doing the TV. So I had I always felt that I had a friend up there in the booth that I could talk, even though I wasn't getting an answer back, but I could, you know, kind of say a few little quips to him and kind of relieve a little bit of the tension, you know. But, you know, to go through that and, you know, Vitas traveled with me for a couple of years, even before that U.S. Open, and, you know, went to Europe. We played doubles at the French together, and then after that, he played the senior tour with me for a couple years, and before his passing. And I mean, he was the ultimate, for me anyway. He was the ultimate, not only player, but for the cocktail parties and the pro-ams and
he was the guy, man.
His what, Brother?
He was the guy, right?
Yeah.
He was a dude.
There was nobody better. I mean, he would walk in and he'd be a part of everything right away. And he was I miss him every day. It's funny. I mean, I don't say that about a lot of people, but his personality and what he brought to tennis, and then everything else that he got around was pretty special.
Hey, Brett, one thought about Vitas, like, it's easy to get caught up in him being the guy and the look and the hair. Hey, Brett, he could play now. Like, Vitas, he got his size number 4, right, in the world. He could play.
Yeah, yeah. He won. Brett, you know more than I, but yeah, he won
the Australian Open.
Yeah, he won Australia. He was in the finals of the French. He was in the finals of the Open. Semifinals of Wimbledon. Davis Cup. I mean, he's had a Hall of Fame career, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. Come on. There's a lot of guys in there with a lot less, that are in the Hall of Fame, that and not to have Vitas in there is a sin.
Hey, Brett, I normally don't keep guys this long, and you guys are now in this game, so you know how this goes, but that's how much fun that was, and I so appreciate it. Brett, if people want to find the podcast, where do they go to find it? And if they want to find you guys on social, where do they go to find you guys on social?
Yeah, we're available on all the major podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts. On Twitter, you can follow us at ADV Connors, and Instagram, you can spell it all out, at Advantage Connors. And we have a YouTube channel, at Advantage Connors. So you can follow us all there and check out the podcast and give us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you guys.
I love that. So how is your photography business?
It's good, man. It's tough right now, just not being able to travel and do so much. But I still get out there. You know, I love taking pictures, and you know, I'm a dork. I got a drone, and I fly that around when I get a chance. And you know, it's fun. I love doing it. It's and if I can make a little money on the side doing it too, it's great.
What a blast, Jimmy! That was so fun. I didn't mean to take so much time, but it was so great to get caught up. Great to meet Brett and have him on the program, Jimmy. That was so much fun. Brett,
fun.
I really appreciate you too. That was great. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
Good being
thanks,
with
Jim.
You. Take
appreciate
care.
It. Later, clones.
My thanks to the Connors, Jimmy and Brett both. What an amazing conversation that was. That was an absolute blast. And make sure you find their podcast, Advantage Connors, wherever you get your podcasts. Hit them up on Twitter. Let them know what you thought of what you just heard. I'm back next week with another episode like I always am. So make sure you get subscribed right now. Until then, here are your coveted voicemails.
First new message.
My dad is 83 years old, African-American male. He gets together with some old high school buddies at Long Beach, where he was the only black person there. They get together, and they had a brunch last year. And to make a long story short, the homeowner had to take off for a minute, and my dad, he goes into the backyard to pick a lemon off of his friend's lemon tree, and his neighbor sees him. She calls the cops. They cordoned off the block and yelled to my father in a megaphone to come out with his hands up. He's on the ground, handcuffed. Finally, the neighbor, the homeowner, sees this from a block away, comes out, lets the police know what's going on, and they let him go. This is not 1960, 1970. This is last year. Blows me away, Rome. That's just kind of a sense as to what we have going on. I appreciate you doing the show, man. This is great. We need to talk about these issues. Thank you.
Message saved. Next message.
Hey, Romy. It's your mate, Elk. Good on ya. Just want to let you know, me and the fellas here, we're going to go out later tonight and get some cat. I think John Daly's going to be there with us. I mean, you're going to call Monty. So we're going to get some custard up in here, you know what I mean, mate? Anyways, you know the number. Give me a ring. Peace.
Message deleted. Next message.
Jimmy Rome. This is Jim from Ohio. I'm laughing my fucking ass off. What you did to Fabian and Parody Larry. It was the best skit you've done. I'm crying. I'm dying, dude. I love it. I'm glad you can make me laugh during this pandemic. Keep up the good work, brother.
Message saved. Next message.
Hey, Jimmy. Johnny in Texas. What's going on, man? Appreciate the show today. Thanks for hitting that topic. I'm totally on board. And any clone who doesn't want to follow you because they don't like you covering social issues, see ya. Don't let the door hit you in the ass. Peace. I'm out, brother.
Message saved. Next message.
Romy, Justin in Melbourne. Hey, Narc Bra, congratulations on having the first Smack Off promo video. But you said it best. You said you're going to be watching that thing from your hot tub. Do us a favor. Stay in the tub and don't make that phone call that day. In fact, the only bra I want to be hearing from is Fake Silk introducing once again Joe Palmieri, the hot dog king of Maine. Come on.
Message deleted. Next message.
Jim, 21-year listener to your show. I live in Kansas City, Missouri, and I just want to thank you for the show you've done today. I think it's actually the most important show you've done. I know you say that you're a sports talk show host, but you have a big microphone, and I think you're a very intelligent, insightful person, and with intelligence and the microphone carries a big responsibility, and you've carried out that responsibility very well. I've never called your show, but I felt so strongly about this, I was compelled to call. Thank you very much.
Message saved. Next message.
Hey, Jim Rome. My name is Tina. I live in La Mesa, where the riots happened. And I'm telling you, there are small businesses crying and freaking out because their businesses were looted and vandalized. It's ridiculous. Something's got to change. In 1992, if they would have prosecuted those cops that beat Rodney King, that was live on the air for the world to see, things would have been different now. Thank you. I'm out.
Message saved. Next message.
Jim fucking Rome. Just want to say thank you for the Brandon Boyd podcast. That was fucking epic. I can never call a show because I have a mouth that makes truckers blush and sends sailors running from the bar covering their ears. But I got to set fire to my thesaurus because it did me no good in that interview. I do want to get on the Brandon Boyd and Jim Rome mailing list for your guys' book club. That would be fucking awesome. I believe there's nobody you can't interview, although I think the one area you haven't tapped, you've got to interview someone from the adult film industry. Make it happen.
Message saved. You have no more messages.